start with the statewide agenda and the federal consistency report. Yes, Mr. Merrill?
Mr. Chair, if it's your pleasure, I'd like to go through the changes to the agenda first.
That'd be great.
Thank you. There are several changes. On agenda page number 15, agenda item 4A, which is the condition compliance for the consistency determination for the U.S. Forest Service, has been postponed. On page 16, item 8A, the Elliott appeal, as marked on the agenda, is postponed. On page 16 also, item 8B, the City of Crescent City permit application, as marked, is also postponed. And then finally, on the addendum, item 10A, which is the permit application from Georgia Pacific, we're recommending be moved to consent. And that completes the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Okay. Director Douglas?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just want to remind folks in the audience, if you're here to address the commission on any item on the agenda, please fill out a speaker slip. They're found on the table outside the room. Get those up here to staff so we can take them on up to the chair. Please turn off your cell phones if you have them on, or put them on vibrate. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. The first item under federal consistency is the non-voting item, the presentation of the negative determinations that were issued within the last month, in case there are any commissioner comments.
Is there any objection to finding concurrence with the executive director's negative determinations? Hearing none, we concur.
Okay, thank you. Our first hearing, and the only hearing item for federal consistency, is going to be presented by Diane Livia from our Energy and Ocean Resources Unit. I want to introduce her because this is her first presentation before the commission, but she's been with the Energy Unit for over a year. She'll be helping out.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Director Douglas.
Anybody who has a BlackBerry up there?
Better shut them off.
If you're near a microphone, that's what that interference is. So
yes.
We would appreciate your cooperation. Thank you.
We will. Thank you, Director Douglas. I think everybody's got them shut off now. I see. I'm still glad that Commissioner Blank, after the third day, is still with us here as a new commissioner. We appreciate it.
It's been easy.
Okay.
It's easy for you to say it's been easy.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, before I turn it over to Ms. Livia, I just want to explain, under federal consistency, just two matters procedurally. The staff recommendation is for a conditional concurrence. And the test before you is whether the project is consistent to the maximum extent practicable with the, essentially, with Chapter 3 of the Coastal Act. And the maximum extent practicable has a definition, which means that they would need to be fully consistent unless there's some law or regulation prohibiting full consistency. And just to comment about conditions, conditions are a little different under federal consistency matters than they are for permits. It's in more of the nature of a recommendation from the commission. If a federal agency chooses not to agree to a condition, then the decision is treated as an objection, and then we go into the procedures that are available if there is an objection. But I just wanted to make that comment. It's not necessarily binding, unless and until the federal agency agrees to it. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Livia.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, commissioners. This is item 3A, a revised staff report and recommendation on consistency determination 072-06 regarding marine protected areas, which NOAA proposes to designate within the National Marine Sanctuary at the Channel Islands. This item was originally on the January agenda, Thursday 12A, but it was postponed at that time. Staff recommends that you conditionally concur with this determination. A bit of background. In 1999, federal and state agencies, including commission staff, began a two-phase collaborative process to create a network of marine reserves around the Channel Islands. This collaboration included as well regional fishery groups and conservation interests. The first phase resulted in the establishment of marine protected areas within state waters of the sanctuary, 10 reserves and 2 conservation areas. They were approved by the Fish and Game Commission in 2002, and they were implemented in 2003. A reserve is an area where certain kinds of extraction are restricted in a conservation area is an area where all extraction of any sort is prohibited. It's called a no-take area. These 12 MPAs in state waters amount to about 102 square nautical miles of protected ocean. The Commission did not review Phase 1, but you're now being asked to consider Phase 2 of this process. And this comes to us from NOAA and the National Marine Sanctuary Program. NOAA proposes to designate an additional 140 square nautical miles as marine protected areas. Their preferred alternative, Alternative 1A, would designate new areas that extend into existing, that extend the existing state MPAs into federal waters, but also overlap the state MPAs. And you have this map in your packet there, but just to take a look here, this is the preferred alternative 1A, and the green sort of rectangular shapes are the existing MPAs in state waters, and the hatched areas are the proposed MPAs that would extend, as you see, those areas, but they would also overlap as it's in this alternative. And this is your Exhibit 1 in your staff report. So why extend the existing MPAs? The tremendous wealth of marine resources in the sanctuary is well documented. The resources found there constitute some of the most significant natural marine assets in the United States and, in fact, in the world. UNESCO has designated the entire Southern California Bight an International Biosphere Reserve. The addition of new MPAs in the sanctuary as phase two of this process would increase biodiversity in these waters and protect the marine resources there. The designation of these MPAs would also restrict commercial and recreational fishing in about 11% of sanctuary waters. This, in turn, could result in about a 1% reduction in the annual value of commercial catch within the sanctuary. However, because we expect the protection of these areas and the fisheries they encompass to increase fish stocks, we believe the closures will be offset by greater fishing opportunities throughout the rest of the sanctuary. NOAA has determined that the proposed project will result in short-term and less than significant adverse effects to commercial and recreational fishing activities, and the staff agrees. However, the Resources Agency does not support NOAA's preferred Alternative 1A. It supports only Alternative 1C, which designates federal MPAs in federal waters only. In their letter of January 2nd, the agency explains that Alternative C is the only alternative acceptable to the state of California. And you have that letter in your staff report as Exhibit 10. Alternative 1C, however, presents a certain challenge in that it would leave small gaps of unprotected waters between the seaward boundaries of the existing state MPAs and the shoreward boundaries of the proposed federal MPAs. And if we can go to the next, Alternative 1C, as you can see here, one of the gaps that would result is designated there on the map. And as you can see, there are a number of the areas that will have gaps in state waters. The staff is concerned that these gaps of unprotected waters would make it difficult for anglers to observe the no-take and restricted-take regulations and that the overall protection of these areas will be compromised. The Resources Agency states it has every intention of closing these gaps in a timely manner. What is in question is simply the timing and the appropriate mechanism for this determination. The staff believes the appropriate mechanism is to condition this consistency determination to provide that if NOAA elects to implement Alternative 1C, the proposal will be temporarily expanded to cover these gaps until such time as the Fish and Game Commission either includes the gaps in the state MPAs or enters into an interagency agreement with NOAA that otherwise establishes MPA protection for these gap areas. The staff believes that this condition would provide the equivalent level of protection as would Alternative 1A, and thus would bring the designation into consistency with the requirement of Section 30230 to protect, enhance, and restore where feasible marine resources. We've received five letters from various organizations on this item in the last few days. Three are in favor of the proposed project. although one of those expresses support for Alternative 1A but not for Alternative 1C based on their belief that administration and enforcement would be more effective with Alternative 1A. And we've had two of the letters opposed to the establishment of additional MPAs because they are not supportive, basically, of any action they believe would adversely affect the commercial fisheries in the Santa Barbara Channel and the supporting facilities. And you have copies of all of those letters. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just some...
Yes, Director Douglas.
Some concluding observations. I have had conversations with representatives of the Resources Agency, Commissioner Baird being one, and we are aware of the Secretary's concern based on an understanding that was reached with the commercial and recreational fishing community. We understand that they're concerned about duplication, and our recommendation takes that into account. What we're saying, and we have to apply the law, and any agreement that was made is important, but it's not the basis on which we can base a recommendation or what we believe is the basis for the Commission's action. Your action must be grounded in the law and the application of the law to the facts. So what we're recommending here is basically an approach that would cover these gap areas unless and until the Fish and Game Commission extends the state MPAs to cover those gaps, at which point the federal jurisdiction moves back to the state boundary. So this is the precautionary principle. It's the most protective, and it avoids duplication. So that's the basis on which we're making the recommendation in terms of applying the law to the facts in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Douglas, for sharing that with us. Yes, Mr. Delplan?
And I'll just mention that we've just received a letter from the Department of Fish and Game that indicates they do intend to initiate the process as early as their May meeting, and they may be able to accomplish filling the gaps in by August of this year.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else from staff? Anything else? Okay. With that, I'll come back and ask for ex parties from the commission, starting on my left, Commissioner Baird.
End of report. Thanks.
Okay. Commissioner Akashi?
Not here, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Actually, I should amend that. Just had some conversations out in the hall with some sanctuary staff and certainly with our department, which is not a reportable thing. And we have had, as the record reflects, ongoing discussions with the sanctuary staff on this.
Okay. Any other commissioners? Hearing none. With that, then I'll open the public hearing. And Greg Helms, please. How much time, sir? That's fine, sir. 2 minutes will be great.
Turn your mic on.
Oh, there it is. Good morning, Chairman Kruger and members of the Commission. My name is Greg Helms. I'm with the Ocean Conservancy. I staff the Santa Barbara Field Office of the Ocean Conservancy, and in doing that, I've been part of the Channel Islands MPA process from its beginning. I believe it's been a tremendous and historic process.
Yes. Excuse me for interrupting, but I think you need to call on the sanctuary first, federal agency that's actually the initiating action.
If not the state as well.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you for that. Okay, thank you for that. Bill DeRose. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and this is on, yes. Members of the Commission, I'm Bill DeRose, and I'm the West Coast Regional Director for the National Marine Sanctuary Program.
How much time, sir?
Maybe 4 or 5 minutes.
5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Chris Mobley is a sanctuary superintendent. He would be here today, but he has a Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting in Santa Barbara today. So I'm here representing our program. Sean Hastings from the Channel Island staff, who's been working on this issue for the last 6 years, is here as well if there's any technical questions. I want to thank staff for their recommendation and their support for our determination that these alternatives are consistent with the California Coastal Act. They've also provided a very helpful summary that was up. And if you get a chance, if you could just put up one, one A or one C, either one of those, or if you can put them up side by side, that'd be great. That might be asking a lot.
You're asking too much.
I know. I thought I might be. Either one is fine if you can put either one up. We are currently in a phase to complete our review of this proposal for the federal action. This has been a process conceived many years ago as a joint effort between the National Marine Sanctuary Program and the Department of Fish and Game to evaluate, consider, and ultimately designate these marine reserves around the Channel Islands. And we've had a very collaborative working relationship with the state since this whole process was initiated six, 7 years ago. Our preferred alternative is still formally alternative 1A. We have not released a final environmental document yet. Nonetheless, the state's letter, Secretary Christman's letter, is very important to us, and we are actively considering alternative 1C for our preferred alternative. The way our process works in under the National Marine Sanctuaries Act is that we have sort of a two-phase process, much like a general plan and a local zoning ordinance. We have a designation document that lays out the authority for our program to regulate activities. That lays out general activities. The regulations are then very specific to the activities that we intend to take. Where the designation document could affect state waters, governors for the state are allowed an opportunity to veto any proposed original designation document or any change to it. So Secretary Christman's clear indication that the state doesn't prefer any designation document changes that would result in our regulating fishing in state waters is a very serious thing for us to consider, and that's why we are seriously considering alternative 1C. The timing of our process is looking like we should have our document done in April and released for public review. That will be the final environmental impact statement. That would include our decision on which alternative to pursue, alternative 1C or 1A or any of the other alternatives. And we have, under the federal rules, there's about a 30-day period where we can't issue any final action. So if we get the document out by the end of April, a final action in June would allow us in June sometime to issue what's called a final rule that would state our intent to issue regulations. Timing that the Fish and Game Department has in their letter is probably something that we can work with. If you assume we're going to pick alternative 1C, one of the things that we certainly recognize is the staff's recommendation that until the point in time when the Fish and Game Commission closes the gaps, we could issue an interim regulation, if you will. But there's also another pretty viable option, especially given these time delays that are inherent in the federal process, and that is that we, NOAA, would wait to issue any final regulation until the state has closed the gaps. And that might be June, July, maybe as late as August, as their letter indicates. And so what I would like to ask as well, maybe it's for the staff to clarify, is if the commission adopts the recommended language that the staff has proposed, and if NOAA is going to pursue 1C, and we choose to wait until the Fish and Game Commission action takes place, is that adequate? Will we still be consistent with the Coastal Act? Now, we believe we are. We believe all these options are consistent, provided the gaps are closed. And I want to emphasize that within the sanctuary program, and we've had a number of conversations with the state, we believe that we and they are united, that this is not a meaningful network until those gaps are closed and until the federal waters portions are designated. So I don't think we envision any scenario where there's going to be gaps at all. We're working hard on these different alternatives that would allow that to happen. And we certainly recognize a temporary 1B, if you will, could create that scenario. Or we could simply wait what might be only 2 months before we even issue our regulation. And that would not create any confusion for any boaters or fishermen because of these inherent timelines that we face. So I just wanted to make sure you understand that while we're looking at these two options and we're seriously considering 1C, if we take this path of waiting several months, let the Fish and Game Commission close the gaps, and then doing ours, and we believe ours is that actually would be consistent with the Coastal Act and with the findings of consistency. And I even think the recommended language and the condition would be acceptable too. But I just want to make sure that the staff can confirm that that's the case. We could do that in July or August and then be done. Thank you.
Mr. Duros?
Yeah.
Sir, would you like to retain 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal?
I'd appreciate that, yes.
Thank you. We'll give you 3 minutes when
Thank you.
Rebuttal. Sankey Mostrop?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Commissioners. My name is Sankey Mastrup. I'm Deputy Director of the California Department of Fish and Game. You've been provided a letter from the director, Ryan Broderick.
How much time are you requesting?
Could I have four, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. You have a letter from Director Broderick that fundamentally requests that the commission consider consistency determination for 1C without any conditions. I'd like to go on, and first of all, the director and the secretary of resources, Mike Christman, we're completely behind completing the designation of the MPAs as proposed by the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary. We're all on the same page on that. We've been working towards this goal since the Fish and Game Commission acted in 2002, over 4 years ago, to designate the marine protected areas in state waters. The director and the secretary believe the most effective way to do this is for the federal government designation or designations to occur in federal waters and the state water designations occur in state waters. This is consistent with existing and historical management responsibilities for living resources and fisheries, and it also, importantly, minimizes confusion caused by overlapping regulatory responsibilities. This is also consistent with the intent and language and adoption process established by the Fish and Game Commission. As you will recall in your briefing, that the original proposal for MPAs in the Channel Islands came from the commission and was originally designed just for state waters. After 1 year of debate in front of the commission, the Department of Fish and Game and the Channel Islands Sanctuary proposed a joint state-federal process and considered MPAs in both waters. The result of this joint process was a recommendation to the commission to establish MPAs within state waters and that a secondary regulatory process would occur to establish MPAs in federal waters. We recommend that the federal MPAs be achieved using Alternative 1C, listed in the draft environmental impact statement. This recommendation follows a lengthy dialogue between the secretary, the Department of Fish and Game, and the sanctuary's program. As noted, this is also consistent with the language in the state regulatory environmental review process documents. It is clearly within the record of the Fish and Game Commission decision back in 2003 that that was their intent when adopting the first phase. Assuming the sanctuary uses option 1C, which limits their action to federal waters, the state will act promptly to close the remaining gaps as was committed to when the commission adopted phase one. The department and the resource agency, and we believe the commission, are committed to completing the network from federal waters clean into state waters without gaps. Our tentative schedule is to go to notice at the May hearing in San Diego. The letter provided has two discussion hearings and adoption hearing in August. However, the department, based on discussions with the sanctuaries and their concern for their timing and scheduling with Congress, we will attempt to hasten that schedule and adopt the regulations by July. But as you know, the commission's a constitutionally created body, and we don't tell them what to do. We recognize the fact that the gaps in protection are a concern. The good news is between the rockfish conservation areas, both for sport and commercial fisheries, and the EFH, the essential fish habitat designations of the council, there's not much activity fishing-wise going on in these areas and gaps currently and will not be in the near future. Therefore, that we recommend that the commission give federal consistency determination to alternative 1C without a condition as noted in the staff report. And we look forward to continuing our strong working relationship, not only with the sanctuary, but the Park Service, which we've been doing wonderful work in monitoring and establishing and enforcing these reserves. And we look forward to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Helms? Do you want the same 2 minutes, sir, or you want three? I'll
yeah.
Give you three for calling you up the second time.
Including the 15 seconds I already got, I think we should be fine with the 2 minutes. As I said, I'm Greg Helms of the Ocean Conservancy. Been intimately involved in these in this MPA planning, this historic process from the very beginning, and continue to do so through the second phase, a third phase of the council, and now we're hearing about a fourth phase. And I agree that we're all on the same page. Conceptually, and the announcement by the Resources Agency this morning is welcome. However, I still am here to support the staff recommendation. The goal here, from my perspective, is to manage the MPAs at the Channel Islands as a cohesive network. I believe that goal is shared. We need a consistent and uniform administrative structure. We need the best obtainable integration among agencies that we can get. And I think the staff recommendation advances that because it assures a contiguous, uniform, unbroken MPA protection as intended from the shoreline of the islands to the sanctuary boundary, and it bridges the gaps. That's a bridging the gaps is sort of the big point one of that integration that I'm talking about, and we think the staff report, the staff recommendation, is a fairly artful tool to bring that about. It also provides insurance in case the sanctuary does go with alternative C and unforeseen complications come up at the Fish and Game Commission. As we just heard, it's an independent agency, and so your suspenders with the belt proposed by the resources agency might be a good combination. So that spatial coherence is job one. Second job I'll just mention very briefly is having an administrative management structure that's integrated and recognizes the ecosystem-based nature of this program. And so we just would take this time to encourage the state and the sanctuary to continue working together as they are to create a management agreement that specifies and lays out an integrated, coherent way of monitoring, of enforcing, and managing the MPAs. We understand that work is ongoing, and we want to strongly support that wherever we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Helms, for coming here today and for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Duros, 3 minutes, your time for rebuttal, sir.
At this point in time, Mr. Chairman, there's nothing that I feel like I need to rebut. I'm certainly able to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. With that, I'll go back to staff for staff response.
Yes,
Director Douglas.
Just a couple of comments here, or maybe more than that. We are on the same page with the administration and the sanctuary. There's no question in our mind that both the secretary and the director of the Department of Fish and Game and the department intend to close the gaps here relative to the marine protected areas. But our responsibility is to apply the resource protection policies of the Coastal Act, and that's precisely what the staff recommendation does. Our recommendation basically is 1B modified. It does, if approved by you, does cover the gaps for that period of time pending approval by the Fish and Game Commission of the expansion of the MPAs in state waters to cover the gaps. We appreciate that there's a desire to complete the MPA expansion to fill the gaps, but we can't be certain what the Fish and Game Commission is going to do. As you know, since you adjourned your first day's meeting in memory of Bob Hatoy, who was the chair of the Fish and Game Commission, there is a vacancy there now, as I understand it. I've had conversations with representatives of the recreational and commercial fishing industry, and it's my understanding, if I get it wrong, I'm sure Commissioner Baird will straighten me out, that they're opposed to any expansion of MPAs. We don't know what's going to happen there. So this recommendation really is precautionary. It does apply the Coastal Act policies and covers the gaps during that period that the Fish and Game Commission has acted. But in any event, as you heard also, if the Commission adopts the staff recommendation here, it doesn't go into effect automatically. If the Governor and the Secretary still object to that approach, then they can take an action which basically suspends the implementation of that condition, and then the issue becomes moot in the sense that it can't be effectuated. And as Mr. Duros indicated, the sanctuary recognizes that, and so the governor and the secretary do have the last say. But I think in terms of this commission's obligation, it's our obligation to be as protective as possible, and I think we've really tried to walk the line here in terms of what the administration is trying to do, which we're on the same page with, and what we think the mandate of the Coastal Act and the application of the law to the facts here would require. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Douglas. And with that, I'll come back to the commission and recognize Commissioner Baird.
Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, what I'm here to say is I think we are at the end of a success story, really. And that success story is that the federal government, through the sanctuary program, and the state government came up with an agreement 4 years ago on what needed to be protected. The state did that protection, but squared off these areas in order to deal with enforcement issues in anticipation of the sanctuary acting. And we had thought that sanctuary might act within 1 or 2 years. In fact, after about 2.5 years, the secretary sent a letter to the sanctuary and said, let's get on with this thing. Let's move this thing as rapidly as we possibly can. One of the biggest lessons of the U.S. Ocean Commission and the Pew Ocean Commission about, and that's Leon Panetta and Admiral James Watkins, is we have too much duplication and confusion in our ocean and coastal management issues. The sort of 1C modified, I think, invites that kind of confusion. If we do some sort of ephemeral federal designation in state waters, I think that is going to lead to confusion. And I think, as the testimony from the Department of Fish and Game indicated, after 4+ years, if we have to go another couple of months to come up with a solution that is pragmatic, predictable, and actually, as Mr. Douglas made the comment that we had a deal with the fishermen 4 years ago about this, that's not the case. If you look at the Secretary's letter, in the Fish and Game Commission proceeding, it was very clear the Fish and Game Commission was going to act in state waters, and we were anticipating action in federal waters by the sanctuary program. It wasn't a deal with the fishermen. It was in a regulatory process through the Fish and Game Commission that came about. I think if you look at the relationship between the state and the sanctuary program, and I've known Bill Duros and all these managers. I was at the very first meeting of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, the first meeting of the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Councils and so forth. We have a great working relationship. The department and the sanctuary have a fantastic on-the-ground working relationship in terms of enforcement and management and so forth. As we move forward with this, again, our recommendation, our strong recommendation, is 1C unmodified. We're going to sit down with the sanctuary program, and we're going to work on a memorandum of understanding to absolutely clarify how we all continue this great working relationship on co-management of these resources. So I guess I can't say in the strongest terms that from the standpoint of the secretary and the director of Fish and Game, we think let's do it right. Let's take the slightly increased amount of time and have the Department of Fish and Game Commission take their action. And let me just make one other point, is that when the Fish and Game Commission took their original action, the intent was to protect all of state waters. And the only reason they did not take that action at that time was because the sanctuary had yet to act. And so if they went out to a squiggly state line, it's not a straight line, it would have been very, very difficult to enforce. So they squared off that designation so that it would be very, very clear to the fishing community where they could or could not fish. So the action that's going to be before the Fish and Game Commission is sort of cleaning up what they did 4 years ago to conform with the sanctuary designation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Baird, for that input. Commissioner Wan?
Just to get this moving, I move that the commission conditionally concur with consistency determination CD07206 that the project described therein is, if modified in accordance with the condition below, would be fully consistent and thus consistent to the maximum extent practicable with the enforceable policies of the California Coastal Management Program, and recommend a yes vote.
To a second to Commissioner Wands. Seconded by Commissioner Riley. Moved by Commissioner Wan, seconded by Commissioner Riley, and their maker and seconder of the motion are asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the agreement with the determination and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Wan?
Yes, just very, very quickly. I recognize what the overall intent is and appreciate Commissioner Baird's comments and desire for this to work forward in as cooperative a way as possible. However, as was pointed out, the Fish and Game Commission still has to act, and they are an independent body, and we don't have any guarantees. And unless the gaps wind up to be actually closed by that body, I do not see how 1C can be considered to be consistent to the maximum extent practicable under the law. And we have to go, I mean, it's all well and good to talk about agreements, but we have to comply with the law. That's not what federal consistency is all about. If we find concurrence, it has to be that we have found that it is consistent to the maximum extent practical. And I don't think you can make those findings if you have gaps there. It's not consistent. It's not the most protective unless those gaps are filled. And what staff has done is to say, with their modification, and by the way, if we were to turn this down, which is I believe that what the sanctuary has asked for was 1A, okay? If we were to go ahead and do and turn down 1A, that certainly wouldn't be consistent. If we accept 1C at this point, I don't see how you make the findings, as long as those gaps are there, that it is consistent to the maximum extent practicable. And as much as you want to go along with this working relationship, I don't see how this undercuts this. Because, as Mr. Doris has said, they're not going to really enforce this until for several months. And what by going with staff, what this does is give the sanctuary the ability that if for some reason the state does not, in fact, fill the gaps, then the sanctuary has the ability to enforce what we all agree is necessary. And this is really the only mechanism by which that can happen. So I am fully in support of the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to propose an amendment. I would move to amend Condition 1 on page 7 of the staff report, and it would read, in the event NOAA elects not to implement Alternative 1A, NOAA will implement Alternative 1C with the provision that it is consistent when the Fish and Game Commission designates the areas in between the existing state-designated MPAs and the three-mile limit, i.e. the gaps between the existing state MPAs and the federal MPAs depicted in Alternative 1C and shown on Exhibit 9, and then delete the rest of the language in that condition.
I second that motion.
It's been seconded by Commissioner Kajian. And I...
Can I speak to it?
Yes. Then I need to go back to Commissioner Riley because he seconded the previous motion. I should have called on him first.
Oh,
so,
I'm sorry.
You know, but go ahead and speak to your motion, then I'll go back to Commissioner
Riley. Just to say that it's obvious from the letters that we've received from other sister agencies within the state that they would really appreciate the opportunity for Fish and Game to take action on this issue. And I don't think that the delay that's being requested, I think it's going to be introduced in May and decided by July, is going to cause any problems. And I think that we should be courteous. It is a win-win situation, and they just need a little time to finalize that. Also, as one of the local government representatives, the fishermen are a big issue for us, and I think it's appropriate that we let the Fish and Game Commission act before, instead of doing the overlay.
Commissioner Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I seconded Commissioner Wan's motion, and I'll support that one. It seems that we have basically a jurisdictional issue here over resource protection and management, and my reading is that the state, even on a temporary basis, is reluctant to support any kind of a federal overlay in state waters for protection because of the precedent that it might set. On the other hand, as Commissioner Wan, I think, correctly points out, our focus here ought to be on the resource protection aspects of this agreement, and the only way that you come to be able to make the finding that's necessary for consistency is if you have fully protected the resource. And it seems to me that the staff has done that. I don't know that the temporary nature of the designation that the staff condition would impose is so serious that we should modify our responsibility for the resource protection aspects of, you know, of this proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. Commissioner Akajian, you seconded the amending motion. Would you like to speak to it, sir?
Just not to repeat everything Commissioner Neely said, but I think the consistency will be very apparent within the short period of time when the Fish and Game will come to play. And a real concern for me is that within the community of Morro Bay, the largest industry is fishing and the only industry, and as is, we're losing that industry to out of state. And it's a real concern to the local jurisdictions within the area that I represent.
Thank you, sir. Commissioner Blank and then Commissioner Clark.
I think this is a question for Director Douglas. I noticed there was an extension that was granted back in, looks like, September. Was that at your prerogative? Who grants the extensions?
That was because of the letter received from the Resources Agency.
And do we have the ability to grant another extension to such that these agencies actually come up with is it in the prerogative of the Commission to grant an additional extension?
Under federal consistency, the extension has to be granted by the federal agency.
So one of these gentlemen could agree to a extension? Is that
sanctuary.
Yes, they could, but let me just make an observation which I failed to make in my earlier comments. Mr. Duros indicated that he would appreciate clarification whether, if the Commission adopts the staff recommendation and the sanctuary holds off acting until after the Fish and Game Commission has an opportunity to act on this, whether or not that's still in conformity with the staff recommendation if adopted by the Commission. And it's our position that it would be. We have no time provision in the staff recommendation. So if they choose to hold off and wait until the Fish and Game Commission acts, they can do so. But they do have the ability to extend the time if they choose to do
that. So we could ask them for a commitment to do so. Right?
You can do that.
Call them up, Commissioner Blaine.
Mr. Duros.
Could you answer?
I should have left my cell phone on. I could race out and take an important call at this moment. I need a minute or two to mull that over. I had about 30 seconds now. I'll yammer for another 30 seconds, then maybe have enough time to think it through. But the thing that I want to point out, and it was embodied in what Commissioner Juan had described, and as Mr. Douglas has clarified, the staff motion provides a lot of opportunities and flexibility to find, you know, one of two or three different solutions, right? It's going to allow, if we go with 1A, we can do that. We know we're facing then a collision with the Secretary of Resources. If we go with 1C, it allows us to wait 2 months and let the Fish and Game Commission take its action and close the gaps. Mm-hmm. What none of us want, that I've ever heard anybody say in this room, but there are others in this state that would want, is to see the entire process stopped. And the problem with a commission action that relies only on 1C with no conditions is that it would allow, for whatever reason that the Fish and Game Commission does not take an action, it would make it difficult for us. We wouldn't have an action that would be consistent with the Coastal Act because your finding would have said 1C only. And that would not only halt the gaps being closed, it would halt the federal waters being designated as well. And what we, as I said, I've been trying to be very clear, we are very cognizant of the Secretary's concerns about our having regulatory authority in federal waters, in state waters. But where we don't want to be, neither we nor the Secretary, and why my view is what's good about the staff recommendations, it keeps those options open, is the State Fish and Game Commission, if they close the gaps in July, we're done, and we don't have to have any jurisdictional fight. If they don't close the gaps, and the Secretary might very well say, you know what, You guys closed the gaps, NOAA. That was envisioned quite a while ago. You guys go and close the gaps, even if it's temporary, until the state takes its action. And that's why the staff's recommendation, in my mind, allows everyone to keep their peace, keep their position, and hopefully the jurisdictional issue gets worked out within, you know, by middle of the summer. And so that's why, now back to your central question, why I'm reluctant to give a time extension. The staff had asked for that before because, you know, quite frankly, we have black and blue shins from the secretary kicking us there saying, get this process done. And in NOAA, and this is, you know, three or four rungs above me in the ladder, they've said, get this process done. And so to extend it, because we choose to, is going to be a problem on our end. We want to get the process done. We've been kicked around enough on this, and we ourselves have other work we got to get on with. And so moving, you know, this one last step to getting the Fish and Game Commission to close the gaps, we'll have this memorandum of agreement that Brian has mentioned solidified. I think we can all move on with implementation, which is where we all want to be.
So I take it that's a no.
That's a no, yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
There is one other question, Mr. Duros, before you leave from Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Duros. So how did you like the proposed amendment?
Well, the Commissioner Neely, the thing I'm worried about, if I understood it right, the proposed amendment would take away this temporary 1B as an option. And we would only need that, the scenario that I've painted, is if the Fish and Game Commission doesn't take its action. And it's not, in my mind, a very efficient way for us to go about it. If there's a way, if your motion could make it clear that, you know, preferred the first step of action for the sanctuary program would be to wait for the state to close the gaps, and then, if necessary, close the gaps under this temporary 1B option, that'd be okay. But I think when you deleted the whole rest of it, I think it took away that flexibility. If in the rare event, I think we all think it's rare, but still not zero probability, that the Fish and Game Commission delays or takes no action to close the gaps.
Actually, that condition doesn't mention, I don't believe, 1B at all. And this is, maybe I'll read it to you again. In the event NOAA elects not to implement alternative 1A, NOAA will implement 1C with the provision that it is consistent when the Fish and Game Commission designates the areas in between the existing state-designated MPAs and the three-mile limit, i.e. the gaps between the existing state MPAs and the federal MPAs depicted in Alternative 1C and shown on Exhibit 9.
Yes, and what I was referring to, and I used our shorthand, the clause that's currently there, until such time as the Resources Agency and Fish and Game Commission designate the areas in between this language, NOAA will expand 1C to include in its MPA designation these gaps. And so that's what we had an alternative that was 1B, right? 1A went all the way to the high tide line, 1B went to the existing boundary, so we closed the gaps with 1B, and then 1C is just in federal waters. So what it was envisioned by the staff in that second sentence is there'd be a temporary period of time, which we can do regulatorily, where our regulation closes the gaps up to the existing reserves, and then when the Fish and Game Commission in the future takes an action, ours would roll back.
Okay. Well,
question.
Thank you, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Duros. And I'm going to go to Commissioner Clark then.
Thank you, Chair. Listening to Mr. Duros' additional input, I'm definitely persuaded in the direction of staff recommendation. I follow several commissioners who believe it is the precautionary and most resource-protective approach, and I think it in the end will drive us to the right overall solution. So that's where I stand on it.
Question.
Okay. Yeah. Commissioner Baird.
Just a couple of clarifications. I'd like to ask Mr. Duros a question and then Mr. Mastrop. Bill, if we get ourselves in a situation, which you know, I think is where we're going to be, where the Fish and Game Commission, you know, we're hoping it'll be July, that they'll make their determination, and that would kick off you guys moving forward and filling in the gaps. I just want to be clear with your response. If it's second hearing in July, the whole thing is moving forward, but procedurally the Fish and Game Commission chooses to go to August, it sounded like you said you might not extend. Do you have to extend in order for the August date to work? And if you do, it was your testimony that you would not seek that extension, or you would?
No, the question was, would I here today grant an extension for the Coastal Commission to take its action later? I wasn't commenting on whether or not we would delay our action one more month. or not. We haven't reached that decision yet. But
okay, good. I just wanted to make that clarification. And then a question for Mr. Master from Fish and Game. The one thing that I think is implied, if I were to pick up the staff recommendation and read the existing proposed condition, it very much implies to me that in order to move this thing fast, the sanctuary should come in and do this designation in state waters, and then the Fish and Game Commission would come in and swap, which strikes me as odd. In listening to the motion that was put forth, I'm curious if in addition to that motion, which says, by the way, to address Commissioner Wan's concern, that this would only be consistent when the Fish and Game Commission acts. That's what I heard. So it's not like the NOAA can go out and do a designation and wait around. What drives it is the Fish and Game Commission. What do you think about adding something onto the end of that, which would say something like, if the commission does not act, then the sanctuary would possibly come in and fill in? Or I mean, is there room there, do you think, or strictly one the amended motion is the preference?
That's a difficult question to answer. Partly because the timing is kind of complicated. There is no doubt in the department's mind that the commission will finish the job. As a matter of fact, as you're well aware, the commission has been working diligently for the last 2 years to do the Central Coast network of reserves and is now going to be dealing with the North Central Coast. This issue is important to us, and I have to be very frank.
Could you speak into the microphone, please?
This has been a very...
It's not working.
Hold on 1 second. Could you make sure the microphone's on?
There it goes.
Yeah, thank you.
I thought I lost my voice. this has been quite a challenge. Those of you who have been watching the commission process, Blue Ribbon Task Force, the stakeholder working groups, there's been a lot of energy put in here. One of the issues that has allowed us to proceed in a rational, constructive way is not having this issue of federal and state overlapping jurisdiction. The key thing the department is concerned about in moving forward and finishing the network, because the Channel Islands is only a very small part of this master vision of marine protected areas. Federal overlay into state waters relative to fishing is going to have a bone-chilling effect on our ability to move forward. I have to be very frank with you. And that is one of the key reasons that we just cannot support any action by the sanctuaries. We are great partners, but we have a job to do in state waters. They have a job to do in federal waters. It's worked well, and we want to continue working that way. Overlap is, from our point of view, going to confound and exacerbate our efforts to finish the job. And that is why we're so fundamentally fixated on 1C with no conditions. Now, getting back to Commissioner Baird's question, if the commission adopts and close regulations to close the gaps, the issue becomes moot, and that is really what we're focusing on. It's obviously your prerogative to decide to add conditions. All we're here to say is that if the federal authority overlaps state jurisdiction, it will cause us significant problems, and that's just all I can add to it. I don't know if that helps you, Commissioner Baird, but that's about as plain as I can put it.
Well, I think the bottom line is the position of the Secretary and the Director, I think, is that in this process, there's just a fundamental opposition to adding this confusion and having this overlay on the thing. We don't think it's necessary, and we believe the Fish and Game Commission will come back and make this really technical correction to finish the process that they started 4 years ago.
And I would like to say...
I think that you've answered Commissioner Baird's question, and it's not fair to the other participants for you to continue to talk. You know, we want to hear from you, et cetera. Commissioner Baird has other questions, et cetera. We should do that. But to be fairness to all the other speakers and people here, I think just if we could stay to the answer of the questions, and that'd be appreciated.
Sorry, I thought I was answering.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, did I. Thank you.
Commissioner Wan.
Well, I continue to agree with Mr. Duros that staff's recommendation and modification provides the greatest flexibility and the long-term ultimate assurance that what everyone appears to be seeking will actually happen. One of the reasons that Fish and Game clearly cannot speak for what its commission will eventually do, because that is an independent body who will have to make that decision. And therefore, I think this commission is back in the position of having to say that unless and until those gaps are closed, you cannot make the findings that it's consistent to the maximum extent practicable, and I think we have no choice but to go with the staff's recommendation.
Director Douglas?
Yes, and I just want to add, as I indicated before, if the commission adopts the staff recommendation and the governor and the secretary continue to object for whatever reason and the Fish and Game Commission doesn't act, they have the authority to block implementation of federal jurisdiction in state waters. So they retain that authority. All you would be doing is doing your job under the Coastal Zone Management Act and the Coastal Act, applying the most protective but flexible solution here.
Commissioner Baer, to be fair, is there anything else you want to add? I know this is important to you. So.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing is that the staff condition, as interpreted by the staff and as the discussion is being put forth, provides no time requirement or any kind of forcing mechanism that says the sanctuary goes out first and does this designation in state waters.
That's correct.
And then what I'm hearing, certainly heard in our discussions with the sanctuary program, is the sanctuary program, and I want to hear from Mr. Duros if I'm misstating this, is willing to work with the Fish and Game Department and the Fish and Game Commission to work this thing out and do the state process and make that happen so that the sanctuary program can simply fill in the remaining areas in federal waters. That's what I'm hearing today in the public testimony. So absent Mr. Duros coming up to the microphone, that's how I'm going to continue to interpret it. And I'm further, and this may be a little bit of a nudge, going to interpret this as Mr. Duros, if he's within 1 month of having a rock-solid situation where the state has acted in its jurisdiction and the federal government has acted in its jurisdiction, that he would probably seek to extend this process to make that happen. Under those understandings that I have, it sounds like we may be pretty close. I don't know if Mr. Mastriff, if you have any other thoughts about that. I think the fundamental issue here is this a condition that's going to allow us to have the Fish and Game Commission go through their process and make this thing work right? That's what we want.
Mr. Musgrove, you can come up and answer Commissioner Baird's questions if you want. Yeah. No? Yeah. Okay. Okay, then we're going to call for the question on the amendment, and they're asking for a yes vote, and anyone needs the amendment read to them again, we can do that. If not.
Just for clarification,
yes.
A yes vote would change the staff recommendation. Yeah. No vote would go to the staff recommendation.
Vice Chair.
Yeah, just for clarification, a yes vote would mean that we honor the jurisdictions, like we argue jurisdiction at this commission every month, and jurisdiction is very important to us, and that we should honor the, not let the federal government take jurisdiction within the state.
Commissioner Blank.
And Commissioner Baird, am I to interpret your last comment as you are now okay with the staff recommendation?
I think our preference remains the language that is exclusive to the state jurisdiction. However, one thing I want to make clear that I think is that we have a situation here which could be a problem for everyone. If indeed that amended motion does not go forth based on the information that has been provided today, it sounds like the next best thing for us trying to work this out in the best possible way we can would be the staff motion, which would allow the state, through the discussions that I have put forth in my understanding, allow the state to move forward. So
that sounds like you could live with it.
That would be, well, my guidance would be preference for the amended motion, but if my understanding and the things that I have stated are indeed the case, then, yeah, it sounds like.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's call the roll, please. The clerk, call the roll.
Commissioner Ashajian.
Aye.
Commissioner Berg.
No.
Commissioner Blank.
Aye.
Commissioner Clark.
No.
Commissioner Neely.
Yes.
Commissioner Potter.
No.
Commissioner Riley.
No.
Commissioner Wan.
No.
Chairman Kruer.
No.
3-6, motion fails.
Okay, and then we're going to go back to the main motion of Commissioner Wan and Commissioner Riley seconded. Does anyone want to say something before I call the question on that one? Yeah, Commissioner Baird.
Yeah, just if it wasn't perfectly clear, since the previous one failed, I think we certainly want to have a regulatory situation that moves us along here, and it sounds like this will allow the state to move first. And so,
thank you, Commissioner Baird. Is there a necessity for a roll call on this? Is there any objection to unanimous approval of this? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all the representations that Commissioner Baird made, we agree with. So with that, that brings us to the North Coast. And I'll ask Mr. Merrill to come forward.
Good morning, Commissioners. That brings us to item 5, which is the Deputy Director's report for North Coast. I'll just mention that this morning and yesterday evening we distributed several items, including a pink addendum, which includes the administrative matters, a green addendum with a letter from the appellant on the Mamer appeal, item 7A, and then individual addendums for item F8C, the Eureka Pacific appeal, and item F9A, which are the revised findings for the Del Norte County LCP amendment. The pink addendum does contain two immaterial amendments, and we recommend that the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determinations regarding those matters. I should point out, though, that for one of the items, the Roth-Wickett Corporation application to modify a vested permit granted in 1988 for a single-family residence in Mendocino County that includes a driveway bridge, that we've received a couple of phone calls from interested neighbors who have concerns about the overall project that was approved. The bridge has been constructed, but the house has yet to be constructed. The amendment is only to replace the railing design for the bridge, and we believe that the bridge railing will be more see-through and will incorporate certain maintenance procedures that will eliminate the need for sandblasting and consequently have less impacts on the environment. So we believe the amendment is consistent with the policies of the LCP and believe it qualifies for processing as an immaterial amendment. Our notice on the amendment only went out this week, so it may be that we'll receive comments from the neighbors before the close of the comment period. In that case, we would report back to you on this item at the April meeting.
Okay.
So through the chair, we'd ask if there are any questions or objections to these items at this time.
Any objection to finding concurrence? Hearing none, the Commission concurs. Consent calendar?
Yes, as I mentioned at the start of the meeting, there's one item that's been moved to the consent calendar, which is the Georgia Pacific application, item 10A. And for the benefit of anyone in the audience who is here for that item, it'll now be heard as part of the consent calendar, where the hearing will be limited to the issue of whether it should be removed from the consent calendar. If it is, then it would revert to its regular place on the agenda. The Georgia Pacific Amendment simply deals with revising several of the special conditions that deal with protections for marine mammals to make them consistent with recent approval by NOAA Fisheries, and also adds archaeological protections to be consistent with recent archaeological surveys. And we recommend that you approve the amendment with the modified special conditions at the close of the calendar of the consent calendar public hearing.
There's no one in to speak on this, no speaker slips or anything. Is there a motion on the consent calendar?
Move approval.
Move approval of the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Potter. Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on the consent calendar, item 10A? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved.
That brings us to item 7A, which is the appeal by Mr. Kevin Reardon from a decision of Humboldt County to grant a permit with conditions to Mr. Brad Mamer to install a pre-manufactured 2,400-square-foot single-family residence and detached 1,000-square-foot garage on a vacant half-acre lot off of Fortune Street in the McKinleyville area of Humboldt County. As I mentioned, the green addendum contains a letter. This is from the appellant, Kevin Reardon, who supports the appeal and argues against the staff recommendation. In addition, the appellant requests that the commission postpone action. And furthermore, the letter notes that staff incorrectly noted the height of the approved manufactured home as 30 feet, although certain documents in the file indicated it would be 30 feet. It's actually 17 feet, so we appreciate him notifying us of that, and therefore we're modifying the findings of the staff recommendation to change every reference to the height to 17 feet. The staff recommends that after the public hearing that the commission determine that no substantial issue exists with respect to the grounds on which the appeal has been filed. The appellant raises two primary contentions in the appeal, including that the approved development is inconsistent with the visual resource policies of the LCP, and that the approved development is in defiance of subdivision covenants, which require prior approval by the architectural committee of the subdivision, and that local approval of this development represents an attempt to interfere with or supersede the subdivision CCRs in a manner inconsistent with the county's coastal zoning code. First, with regard to the visual contention, the staff has observed the other homes in the area and believes that there are many homes that are both single and two-story, similar height, and we believe that it's not inconsistent with the character of the area. We'd point out that it is a developed subdivision. This is one of the last vacant lots in the subdivision. The appeal makes reference to how the area should be characterized as a special community under the definition of the Coastal Act that's also contained in the LCP. However, we note that it has not been designated as a special community in the LCP and that we don't believe it actually meets the definitions, nor is the site actually designated as a coastal scenic coastal view area in the LCP, nor as an area where a design review combining zone would be applied, which is typical in areas where there are sensitive visual resource concerns. The appeal makes reference to the fact that the county will soon be developing a secondary bicycle route for the coastal trail that will pass by Murray Road adjacent to this property. While that's true, we don't believe that the design of the house will have any impact on the design. And so therefore, we believe the project raises no substantial issue of conformance with the visual policies of the LCP. Now, I do have several slides to show you just to give you a sense of the character of the area. And I'll just quickly go through those. Next slide, please. If you could move to the next, thank you. This is a map of the area, and the project site is located roughly there along Murray Road. This is the bluffs along the Mad River, the ocean out this way. You can see from the parcel map, it's a developed area. The Hammond Trail, which is a part of the coastal trail, does go along the bluff edge, and the secondary bike route that's proposed would extend along Murray Road. Next slide, please. This is a key to the other photos that I'm going to show you. This is slide 3. You can see various numbers here. These relate to the photos that will follow, so you know that they're in proximity. Next slide, please. Now, this is actually a photo of the same design of the manufactured home that was approved. This happens to be another home of the same design about a mile away, but this is what the approved project would look like. Next slide, please. These next series of slides, as I say, are just, and I'll quickly go through them, are just other buildings in the area. This is directly across the street from the subject property. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide. There are some two-story. This is actually a multifamily residential home. Next slide, please. And the next slide. Again, please. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. And the next slide. And we're back to, for comparison, this is, as again, the design that was actually approved. Thank you. The other issue raised on appeal is the issue concerning the contention that the approval is in defiance of the subdivision covenants. Now, staff believes this is an invalid grounds for appeal, as the contention was not included in the original appeal, which was the appeal was filed in a timely manner. This came by way of a supplement to the appeal, which was filed after the close of the appeal period. So it's invalid in the sense that it wasn't timely filed. But even if it were, staff believes that the contention would not raise a substantial issue in that the policies of the LCP do indicate that the LCP, in applying the LCP, it's not the intent to supersede any easement, covenant, or other agreement between private properties. So to the extent that the CC&Rs apply to the project and require some further review by the local design committee, the county's approval does not otherwise relieve the applicant of those responsibilities or in any way interfere with the CC&Rs. So therefore, in conclusion, staff would recommend that the commission adopt the staff recommendation as modified to correct the references of the height of the approved house, as I mentioned in the beginning, and find that the appeal raises no substantial issue because the appellant's contentions are invalid grounds or not substantial issues. The motion to adopt the staff recommendation is found on page 13. That concludes my remarks, Mr. 13, Chair.
Just a clarification on it. It was 5 on the previous one. Is that because of the addendum or something? Is it on 13?
Yeah.
The
motion?
But let me just double check. I believe the motion's on
Page five.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. Thanks.
No problem, Mr. Merrill. Thank you for your testimony and report this morning. And with that, I'll go to the commission for ex parties on this, starting on my left. No ex parties. Oh, thank you. Okay. And with that, I'll open the public hearing. Because this is a question of substantial issue, the chair is going to, typically I would take the appellant, and I don't see a speaker slip from the appellant here. I have just one speaker slip. It looks like it's from the applicant, Brad Mammer. So you're just here to answer questions. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Okay, and with that, I'll close the public hearing. I'll go to Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the commission determine that appeal number A-1-MEN-07-007 raises no substantial issue with respect to the grounds on which the appeal has been filed under Section 30603 of the Coastal Act and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Moved by Vice Chair Neely, second by Commissioner Riley. The maker and seconder are recommending a yes vote, and passage of this motion will result in the findings of no substantial issue and the adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in this staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Vice Chair Neely? Commissioner Riley, would you like to speak to your second? Thank you. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission then finds that appeal A1HUM07007 presents no substantial issue. Thank you. And we'd like to, Mr. Merrill, take a 5-minute, and if everybody could just make it 5 minutes, file break here for a second before we go into the next item. And I think that's 8C.
Steve just texted me and said, is it okay without me? the same.
Let's start the continue the hearing today. And Mr. Merrill, are staff ready, or are you ready to proceed with the next item 8C?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Item 8C is an appeal by Commissioners Caldwell and Juan from a decision of the City of Eureka granting a permit with conditions to Eureka Pacific LLC to construct an approximately 44,000 square foot retail commercial sales complex on two boundary adjusted parcels comprising a combined area of about 3 acres situated between Highway 101 and the Marr Marsh off of Broadway in Eureka. There is a handout which is an addendum for this item. It contains a corrected motion for the recommendation and a letter from the applicants as well as responses from the staff to that letter from the applicant. And finally, there's a letter from the Environmental Protection Information Center in support of the staff recommendation. The project site is a former truck terminal site located along Highway 101 between the highway and Marr Marsh, which is part of an approximately 60-acre marsh complex lying between the site and the shoreline of Humboldt Bay. The project would include demolition of the existing development on the site and redeveloping it with the aforementioned commercial complex. The applicants have indicated they would like to lease the facility to a tractor equipment sales business, and a smaller building that would be located along the highway may, we understand, be used for a fast food restaurant. The commission found substantial issue with the appeal on June 16th, and since that time, the applicants have submitted several changes to the proposed development's layout for purposes of the commission's de novo review. The plan changes include reducing the building and outdoor storage yard coverage and substituting a paved tractor display area within portions of what had previously been planned as the former outdoor storage yard and parking lot, which would result in two buildings comprising 43,390 square feet of building floor area plus outdoor storage area. In an effort to afford better protection of the sensitive habitat, which was the issue on appeal, the applicants have expanded the wetland buffer between the site improvements and the edge of the habitat with a variable width buffer that varies from 34 feet to 63 feet with an average of approximately 50 feet. In addition, the applicants propose to include a variety of design features, including barriers, signage, landscaping, and other remedial actions within the adjacent wetlands to enhance the buffer design. We note that the continued de novo portion of the hearing has been scheduled for at least two separate commission meetings prior to this. In each case, the staff's prepared recommendations for denial, and the applicants has either exercised their right for a postponement or requested a postponement, which was granted, for the stated reasons that they thought that with additional time, they may be able to redesign the project to meet the concerns about the buffer width. The project still does raise concerns for staff about the buffer width, and therefore we're recommending that the commission deny the coastal development permit application, primarily because of the issues involving the protection of adjacent habitat with a reduced buffer. Notwithstanding the changes that have been proposed by the applicants, we continue to believe the buffer would not be adequate. The staff has analyzed the proposed reduced buffer and feel that while it may be possible to reduce the buffer from the default buffer width of 100 feet to something to 50 feet, if a 50-foot buffer were provided with native species plant screening, a solid barrier, and some of the additional things proposed by the applicant, we feel that the specific proposal put forward doesn't quite meet that. The 34-foot width we feel is inadequate in the narrow spots, primarily because there's not sufficient room to allow for the planting of willows that would be able to mature to a canopied dimension, similar to the riparian vegetation that exists around the site. The willow trees around the site typically have canopies of 20 feet. The 34-foot width would obviously not be sufficient to allow for a couple of those trees and other vegetation to grow in that area. As a consequence, the effectiveness of the buffer in shielding the adjacent ESHA from light, noise, the human activity associated with the retail project would diminish through that reduced buffer area. We also note that there are different alternatives available that would provide for a uniform 50-foot wide buffer. The applicants have designed a tenant-specific site plan layout with particular building sizes, locations, and orientations chosen to accommodate the particular criteria of the tractor sales business that they're targeting. Even with that specific business, we feel that there is some flexibility with the design and that the proposed parking stalls are 1.5 to 2.5 feet wider than that required by the LCP, and that there are no compact parking spaces provided. If they were to reduce the size of the parking spaces, they could gain as much as 2,800 square feet of additional area. And given that the additional area needed to expand the narrow part of the buffer is only on the order of 1,100 square feet, we think there are some possibilities there of reducing the size of the parking to achieve the bigger buffer. Alternatively, the sizes of the buildings and the sales areas could simply be reduced. As noted in the staff report, at one point, the applicants did previously submit a preliminary site plan showing a configuration of buildings with the minimum 50-foot wide uniform reduced buffer, which is Exhibit 12 in the staff report. However, in their letter of December 11th, submitting the current site plan, the applicants indicate that this configuration was rejected by the prospective tenant. But we feel that the fact that a plan has been produced is evidence that there is a building that could be built for a commercial use that would satisfy the 50-foot minimum buffer. Or simply, the applicant could choose to renovate the existing 9,150-square-foot truck stop terminal building that exists on the site rather than demolishing it. So we feel there are feasible alternatives to the proposed project that could be developed at the site without having to reduce ESHA buffer protections. Therefore, we believe the development is not consistent with the ESHA protection policies and the standards of Chapter 6 of the Land Use Plan and of the Coastal Zoning Regulations and should be denied. Now, to help frame the buffer issue, I would like to show a series of four slides. The slide on the screen now, slide 2, is the site plan. It's a little difficult to see from far away, but essentially, here's the large retail building. The smaller fast food restaurant building is located here. This is Broadway, Highway 101, as it goes through Eureka. The habitat area is to the left or the west, and this shaded area is the buffer. And generally, it's, as I say, it averages 50 feet, but in this area, at the essentially the southwest corner of the building, is where it reduces down to 34 feet, where we have the concern. This slide is a picture taken across Highway 1 looking down at the site. The building I'm pointing out is the existing truck terminal, and you can see that the wetland area includes part of this grassy area, and then it transitions into the Marr Marsh, which, as you can see in the background, is adjacent to Humboldt Bay and is one of the more significant wetland complexes in Eureka. The next slide is an aerial. You can see the project site is what I'm pointing to. This is the truck terminal building as it exists now. The Marr Marsh is the area immediately adjacent. To the north of that is the Palco Marsh, another area called Railroad Marsh. This is the railroad and the mudflats of Humboldt Bay. Altogether, you have about 60 acres of wetland complex. And I'd like to point out that we feel the buffer width issue is particularly important here because, as you can see, unlike some of these other developments, the Eureka Pacific site has a relatively larger frontage along the marsh complex, and it also projects into essentially the middle of the marsh complex, where the impacts of adjacent development would be more acutely felt. We're also concerned that the development to the north is one that's an older structure. It very well could be proposed for redevelopment in the future as well, and we're concerned about the precedent that might be set for this Eureka Pacific project affecting the future development of that site. Here is the policy in the Eureka LCP. As you can see, it does say the buffer shall be 100 feet, but it does provide that it can the buffer can be reduced if the reduced buffer would achieve the purposes of the buffer and protect the resources of the habitat area. That's the end of the slides. I just want to comment on a few other issues that were brought up in the letter that was submitted by the applicants. They point out that Fish and Game has looked at the project and has approved the buffer width, and we'd simply point out that Fish and Game doesn't have a direct regulatory role here, and that in whatever determination Fish and Game was making, they aren't evaluating the project for consistency with the LCP ESHA buffer policies, as the commission must do in this case. The applicant attributes a series of statements to the commission staff biologist, Dr. Dixon, upon which the applicants indicate they've based their perspective on the buffer's adequacy for protecting the ESHA. We've reviewed those comments with Dr. Dixon, and while he can't be here, we have spoken to him, and he agrees that the appropriateness of reduced buffer widths were generally discussed at the June 16th site visit, especially with regard to areas along structural facades where no exterior lighting, window openings, or intensive human activities such as loading dock operations would be sited. However, Dr. Dixon states that no specific on-site determination was made or counsel given to the applicants as to the LCP consistency of a proposed segment of buffer with widths of less than 50 feet. And furthermore, Dr. Dixon observes that a reduction in width below 50 feet and the associated reduction in the relative degree of screening that the landscaping would provide through the narrowed segment would be accompanied by a resulting loss of habitat value. In addition, the applicant opines that the 34-foot minimum buffer should be adequate to protect the relatively low-value wetland immediately adjacent to the proposed development. This apparently is based on the understanding, as you can see from the slide, the area immediately adjacent to the buffer and the development is a grassy area that has low-level vegetation. However, as you could also see from the slides, we feel that it's important to protect the larger marsh complex and the 60-acre complex on the middle of the Eureka waterfront adjoining Humboldt Bay. And finally, there's a statement in the applicant's submittal that the staff recommendation is contrary to law and that it would require an exaction of property without a suitable proportional nexus. And this contention cites key case law decisions requiring prerequisite conditions and evaluations which must be in place or performed by any public agency applying an exaction on private property. We point out that the staff is recommending denial of the requested coastal development permit, not conditional approval. So there is no exaction that would be applied under the staff recommendation. Furthermore, if the commission chose to approve it, we would recommend that the commission impose a deed restriction that would not exact the property to any other party, but would limit how the applicant uses the buffer area to ensure that it would achieve the buffering purpose that it's intended for. So in conclusion, we believe that the project is inconsistent with the ESHA buffer policies of the LCP, and we're recommending denial. I do need to point out, and I'll try to remind you again before you vote, that the motion and the staff recommendation is in error, and there's a corrected motion on page 2 of the addendum. And the motion would be to approve the permit for the development proposed by the applicant, and staff would continue to recommend a no vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, this project has been before the commission for a considerable amount of time, and I find it really frustrating because we had made it very clear right from the beginning that a 50-foot setback was the minimum setback that our biologists indicated was necessary to protect this area. I don't know what about 50 feet isn't understood, and the last time this was before you, we were asked to continue it by the applicant, and I made it clear on the record that we were willing to support a continuance only if the applicant were serious about revising their plans to comply and respect the 50-foot buffer. That hasn't happened, and I find that very unfortunate. And frankly, we would not have agreed to a continuance before. We thought we were going to spend the time to work this out so that they do have a developable project here, which we think they do, but not at the risk of compromising the setback that's already reduced from the 100 feet. So with that, we leave the recommendation as it is.
Thank you, Director Douglas. That was my recollection of events also. With that, we'll go to the commission and ask for ex parte, starting on my left. Vice Chair Neely.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, mine are on file.
Okay. Any other commissioners? Hearing none. With that, we'll open the public hearing, and we'll go to the applicant first, Betsy Bigby. Miss, you've requested 5 minutes.
Five minutes, please.
Yes.
And I want to thank Mr. Merrill for being so thorough in setting the context for this discussion, because it will save me time.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Betsy Bigby, speaking for Eureka Pacific Properties.
Okay.
It'll save me time in going over. I've been told I only have 5 minutes. I thought I had 10, so if this seems rushed, I apologize.
Well, Mr. Atkins is taking some of your time, so you might have you. He's the one you want to hold responsible.
This is just setting the context of where the project is in Eureka. Here's an aerial of Humboldt Bay. There's the Pacific Ocean, obviously, Humboldt Bay. The red dot marks the project site. This is kind of zeroing in, showing here the truck stop use and the trucks that are parked on what has now been designated as a gravel parking lot wetland. These are trucks. Mower Marsh is over here, standing water, again, the project site. That was just a letter establishing that the project was fully occupied and being run as a truck stop up until the beginning of this permitting process. So it was not a vacant site when we started this. The area that we're going to be discussing primarily is here where these trucks are parked. This is as if you were standing in that corner looking out toward Highway 101, looking at the area that has now been designated as a wetland and that gravel parking lot. And we are providing in this area the full 50-foot setback. This is the same corner looking north toward Vigo Street. This is the area off to your right where we'd be providing the slightly reduced 34-foot setback. Again, showing you perspective. This is the side as if you were looking at it from the Mower Marsh. Here's the Mower Marsh standing water. This is the area of contention. Right about over here on our site. This is a homeless encampment. Unfortunately, the site right now serves as a gaping hole in the protection offered by the developments along Highway 101, naturally buffering the Mower Marsh, Palco Marsh, Railroad Marsh from the Highway 101 activity. And it serves as an absolute magnet for homeless encampments. As a matter of fact, the property owner, Randy Cook, has actually had to encounter transients living in the truck stop building and ask them to please leave. When they left, they headed right out to the Mower Marsh. This shows what's happening to the wetland out there. Obviously, human excrement is getting in there as well. There are no outhouse or sewage facilities available in the marsh. This is an aerial that shows clearly this place is dotted with homeless encampments. This is the extension of Vigo Street. To give you some context, again, litter and homeless encampments littered throughout that marsh area. This is just showing that the staff did say they would support the project if we were able to provide the uniform 50-foot buffer, which we have done in all areas except that one southwest corner. This is a close-up of the corner showing why it is so significant to our site that you consider what we're asking you to concede. The gravel parking lot wetlands where those trucks were parked has a 68-foot impact measured on the diagonal from the property line. In addition to that, we're conceding 34 feet to provide for the buffer. The net impact on the development is 102 feet in from our property line. It's as you can see, we've already had to cut the corner of the building for our tenant in order to be able to accommodate just the 34 feet. Our tenant has told us they won't go any further and stay on that site. This is kind of an excerpt from the conceptual landscape plan showing, again, that here's the wetland being protected. Here's the first row of willow trees, which should grow abundantly there. There's two rows of red alders, and we have planted a row of wax myrtle close up to the building as a screen. It's a very fast-growing vegetative plant. It'll provide a screen while the other two, the other three rows of trees are developing. Want to make a point about what Mr. Merrill just said about the canopies of these willow trees that are growing naturally over in the riparian habitat and how big those canopies are. Misha Schwartz, our environmental consultant, who is here to answer questions, told me earlier today that because this area here, which was a berm, it's like all the property, all the dirt from the top of this property was bulldozed 50-plus years ago to the back of the site, and it created an earthen berm. And what happened was there was nothing growing on it, so non-native species started to invade, Himalaya berry, English ivy, etc. And then eventually coming into fill up after the fact were willow trees. So the willow trees out there are a lot less sparse because they have an understory of Himalaya berry. That's why their canopies are so big. Nope, I've been telling to hold that. Hurry up, Sue. This is an our architect's conceptual rendering of what our project will look like when it's built out. Here we have the 50 to 60-foot alders, the willow tree outline. The myrtles won't really even be visible at this point when it's all mature. This shows that the corner that we're actually going to be reducing the setback in is a good 538 feet away from the area of greatest activity, the intersection of Vigo Street and Highway 101. This, again, is a cross-section of the landscape design, conceptual rendering showing the myrtle trees, which will grow fast to screen right up against the building and kind of provide immediate screening, while the two layers of the red alder grow in and the willow trees. This is the preserved wetland area. This is just confirming that all of that can be implemented within 30 feet distance from the building. This is from the Department, State of Washington, Department of Ecology Erosion Control, showing that the planting recommendations we're submitting are reasonable. This is a retouch photo showing what it will look like when it's fully grown out. This roof line is shown at the 30-foot elevation. This here is showing that the trees will tower above that. This here is focusing in on this area here, showing the first silhouette shows what area would be provided on the ground in that area by a strict 50-foot uniform setback or buffer area. The bottom silhouette shows what we are proposing, what we're actually providing on the ground. You can see that in our proposal over here where it's constricted to 34 feet, you lose a little bit of land, but you make it up over here, right in here. So we're just shifting that little bit of area from here to there. This is in complete compliance with the Department of Fish and Game guidelines. I have had personally numerous conversations with them, and they've confirmed that we've interpreted what proposing adequately.
Ms. Bigby, your time's up. Thank you.
Can I have one
unless
more
you
minute?
Want part of Mr. Atkins'
two more,
time.
One more minute. I'm almost done. Okay, this is just showing that the Department of Fish and Game twice now found the project is not likely to result in adverse impacts to biological resources. When we submitted the most recent plans, they actually found that it appears to further improve protection of the adjacent habitats. This area here, which is where the truck stop, where the loading dock is, and what we were told by staff was the area they were concerned most with impact, we provided 52 feet. We were able to give an additional 2 feet in this area, which will allow us to plant another row of trees here to further buffer the development from the habitat. This is the conceptual rendering again. This is showing the site, homeless encampments. This is just really quickly, I want to make abundantly clear. It's very unfortunate. The tenant that we have selected for this site is called Tractor Supply Company, but they do not sell tractors. We're not going to be parking John Deere's and Caterpillars out on that lot. The biggest thing they sell are these little ride-on lawnmowers. They sell big toolboxes. They sell feeding troughs for animals. That's why they require big parking places, but they don't require very many of them. In fact, the net reduction in the area of the parking field for this tenant is 6,000 square feet, as shown in this illustration. The yellow area represents the parking field required by this tenant. The red area is the increase in parking area that would have been required if it were a standard retail tenant.
Ms. Bigby, that's
1 minute.
Ms. Bigby,
133 fewer trips.
Ms. Bigby, I have to ask you to. We had an agreement on the time with Mr. Atkins and you. You'd have a total of 15 minutes. Of which 2 minutes could be rebutted. So you've now used 6 minutes. So you have, okay, you have 9 minutes left. So you want to take 7 minutes and 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Thank you. That'll be great.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Douglas Akins from GCA Law Partners in Mountain View. I'll try to be quick, too. The news that disturbs us is that the two legal bases for denial of the project are both factually and legally unfounded, and I want to demonstrate that in as summary but clear a way as I can. The good news is that when the bases for your decision are properly characterized, they amply support a decision to approve the coastal development permit. What you've seen from the written material submitted to you in the slides today is supports several big lessons. The biggest one is that the site in its existing condition has damaged the marsh and degraded it over multiple decades. Bad stuff moves westerly toward the marsh. Noise, light, glare, bums, kids on bicycles, you name it, shopping carts, motorcycles, dust, litter, you name it. Good stuff moves east out of the marsh, wildlife, and gets killed there. It's a parking lot. It's a compacted gravel no man's land. The essential buffering that occurs in our program is provided to the 90 or 95th percentile by the wall and the building itself. It's a six-foot wall, 400-some-odd feet away from Highway 101. If you put the same wall next to Highway 101, you'd do almost as good a job of buffering, except for light and noise. Moving it as far west as possible enhances the efficacy of that wall. At the corner, southwestern corner, where we don't have the room to put additional plants, we do have a 28-foot-high building. That building also provides very effective buffering from light, sound, noise, everything else. Our wall stops 95% of everything bad from moving into the marsh. The additional buffering effect provided by the landscape vegetation is partly simply to enable us to get additional height above the wall so that the light and dust isn't as bad, and also to establish the marsh immediately adjacent to the wall. We take compacted, polluted parking lot and turn it into marsh. Now, the purpose of the marsh, of our planting, is not to be a permanent feature. The staff has said, well, some of the plants might die. It might be too shady. They might be too cramped. Well, the purpose of that landscape area is to give a head start to the natural regeneration process of the marsh itself. It's there to temporarily to shade out non-native species, to provide a welcoming environment for wildlife and other plants and animals that use habitat like that until after the first year when there's five or six species planted by us. In 10 years, there should be 20 or 30 species through natural regeneration, propagation, and blending of the landscape buffer border with the marsh border. Ideally, our head start is all that we can accomplish, but it will accomplish the effect over time of a stable natural ecosystem. In that sense, it's not subject to staff's criticisms or, as they say, concerns about some of the plants dying or perhaps being too crowded or not being an effective buffer permanently. It can't and won't be a permanent buffer. It's not intended to be. Okay, the staff's boiled down their recommendation for saying that we don't comply with the LCP to the fact that they don't believe we're adequate. They have not specified any qualitative elements of our mitigation program that are not working, that aren't effective. It boils down to their statement that a minimum uniform 50 feet spatial separation is necessary and an average 50 foot separation is inadequate. Well, unfortunately, the term adequate is open-ended. We don't know what it means. The law helps us. Adequate is in the eye of the beholder. I think it was shown on the facts that these two buffer systems function equivalently well, that they function almost identically. They occupy almost identically the same area, and they have identically the same plants in them. They also have identically the same wall and building, comprising the greater portion of the buffering effect. The law says that no public agency in California can impose a mitigation requirement that violates the nexus test, and you're all familiar with that. It means that the commission must show that there's a rough proportionality between the adverse impact of a project and the mitigation burden. Well, in this instance, it's easy to see and well documented in the administrative record that the project itself is a net positive impact. You plug the gap on the western side of Highway 101 with a big building and an active use with a completely blank 6-foot high and 28 foot high cliff on the western side. No wildlife can go east into the freeway and get killed. No light, glare, humans, transients, you name it, can escape west into the marsh because of the buffer system. And so the project, not only does it enhance the marsh by creating 24,000 some odd feet of new marsh immediately adjacent to our wall, but it also stops the intrusions into the marsh 100%, and it stops escapes from the marsh of valuable resources 100%. So on paper, we have shown in the record that we do protect the marsh. We have therefore carried our burden of satisfying the LCP. The burden of satisfying the nexus test is, of course, the commission's burden. When you have a balancing test that requires adverse impacts to be mitigated by to impose the limit of mitigation, but you have a project that is a net positive impact, then no further mitigation can be legally imposed. Staff has a response to that. They say, well, yeah, the nexus test might very well apply, but not to a denial decision. That is clever but false. The issue here is that if the commission is illegal for them to have an illegal basis for imposing an exaction, it's also illegal if they use the same violation of the nexus test to refuse to approve a project. It's, to use a silly analogy, if a gang of thugs sits at the base of a bridge and says, you can pass this bridge only if you give me the contents of your wallet, it's equally illegal for that gang to say, you can't pass this bridge because you have refused to give me the contents of your wallet. The nexus test that puts an upper limit on what you can exact in the way of private property dedications applies regardless of whether you prove the project with an invalid condition or deny the project for the same reason. Staff's response, unfortunately, cannot apply.
Mr. Atkins?
Yes.
I'm going to let you have an additional 2 minutes because looking at the
yes.
two additional speaker slips, City of Eureka is for it, and the other, Schwartz, is here for answering questions only. So you get a total of 15 minutes between you and Ms. Bigby. So you can have the additional 2 minutes. There will be no rebuttal.
I appreciate that. And that's what would be my choice in any event because I have another major point to capture, and that is the point of the alternatives. The second basis staff has used to recommend denial is that they believe, and they simply posit without support, that other feasible alternatives exist to project approval. Well, then they use CEQA. They say CEQA mandates disapproval when feasible alternatives exist that would substantially lessen the project impacts. Let's back up and break that down. First of all, in order to be mandated by CEQA, an alternative must substantially lessen the project adverse project impacts. We've seen from the displays to date that the functional efficacy of the two competing mitigation systems, an average 50 foot and a uniform 50 feet, are identical. They cannot point to anything in the record that shows that a uniform 50 foot buffer is any more effective than an average 50 foot buffer. Their proposal does not substantially lessen the impact. In addition, it must be feasible. We've shown in our submittals that it is neither functionally feasible to accommodate the minimum space requirements of the tenant, economically feasible, and we've tested that by finding out that the tenant, in fact, will not implement the project. In CEQA law, failure to implement a project defines specifically the point of infeasibility. If a project will not occur for economic reasons, then that is the point of economic feasibility. We have reached that point. In addition, it's legally infeasible, looping back to the same rationale I mentioned before, if indeed the commission cannot enforce a condition that it violates the nexus doctrine because that condition is illegal, then of course that condition is approving the project with that illegal condition imposed is legally infeasible. Three separate reasons why it's infeasible and the factual reason that it does not substantially lessen the impact on the environment. In addition, both the staff report and the letter submitted by EPIC make another fundamental CEQA misinterpretation, and that is they think a different project is a competing alternative. That's not the case.
Mr. Atkins.
Eureka approved this project.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Misha Schwartz, you're here for questions only. I just want to thank you. And Sydney Olson from the City of Eureka. 3 minutes, ma'am.
3 minutes is fine. Thank you. I'm Sydney Olson. I'm a senior planner with the City of Eureka, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak. I have a great deal of respect for my colleagues in the Coastal Commission staff, Mr. Merrill and Mr. Baskin. I'm here to represent the City of Eureka, and the City of Eureka fully supports economic development that's appropriately sited and conditioned. And as much as I have the great deal of respect to my colleagues in the Coastal Commission, I respectfully disagree with their findings with regard to the buffer area. The City of Eureka supports the science that has been presented to you that the project as proposed would comply with our LCP. I would respectfully request of the Commission that you approve this project If you agree that the buffer is not adequate, we would ask that you, the City of Eureka would ask that you condition this project so that the applicant has a project that's approved, that they can do the redesign and move forward. They've put together a great deal of expense to this point, and without a project approved, the city's concern is that they may back out of the project and we would end up with a vacant, dilapidated area that will, again, draw more transients than hopefully reduce the problems that we have. We are the adjacent property owner. We do own the Mauer Marsh, so we share concerns both as a regulatory agency and as a property owner with the impacts that are happening with transient occupation of the marsh. I'm going to stop at that point. I don't think there's any point to go any further and berate you or make any other suggestions. And that's not my intent. My intent is to support your commission and to ask that you would do approve the project and, if necessary, to condition it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for not berating us. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing, and I'll go back to staff. And Director Douglas, do you want to start off, or Mr. Merrill?
Right. I'm going to start out just to address one point that Mr. Atkins made. He raises the nexus argument here, and I would just point out to the commission, you are obviously very familiar with the whole question of rough proportionality and nexus, and the fundamental flaw in his argument is that those cases refer to conditions that are imposed that include a possessory interest. There is no possessory interest like public access that's involved here at all. This is a conservation issue. This is a matter of protecting environmentally sensitive habitat. It doesn't in any way impinge on the exclusive ownership property rights of the applicant. So that's not an applicable analogy or argument here in any event. Let me turn it over to Bob to respond to some of the other points that were made.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. I just have a few additional comments. With regard to the slides of the homeless encampments, yes, they are there, but we don't feel that whether they were there or not has any impact on how this development needs to be designed in a manner that doesn't create its own impacts on the wetland habitat. I'd also point out that in some of the slides, there was a suggestion that there's 102 feet of space between the building and the well-developed riparian area. While that's true, what may be lost sight of is that there still is about a 50 to 70 foot wide area of wetland between the building and the well-developed riparian that also is subject to the buffer policies. And over time, with cessation of the trucks parking on that area, will in turn likely be enhanced through natural propagation. The fish and game comments, I just reiterate that they did not, they were not in a position to make a judgment that is consistent with the LCP. That is your responsibility on the appeal. Parking issue, yes, the parking requirements for this development are less than some other commercial developments, but that doesn't mean that they can have a relaxed standard on the buffer. They still must meet the buffer policy of providing protection for the habitat resources. The attorney suggests that it may be sufficient simply to improve protections for the buffer. We think that implied in the buffer policy that would allow a reduction of a buffer of 100 feet to something less is that there must be a sense of that what is remaining will be adequate to protect the resources. And while it is true that they are improving over the existing situation, we feel that the 50 feet is needed. Again, we focused on 50 feet as the minimum when applying the buffer approach that they have of planting vegetation, because with a smaller width, it really reduces the available area for planting. And you can plant plants, but I think many of us as home gardeners have had the experience of planting plants too crowded, and you end up shading the vegetation. It doesn't grow to full maturity and provide the kind of benefit that you're hoping to achieve by having a substitute vegetative screen. There are feasible alternatives. As I noted, the applicants themselves at one point had submitted a plan that would have provided the uniform 50-foot buffer, but that was rejected by their tenant and by the applicants. The commercial zoning for the site is not exclusive to tractor equipment. It allows for a wide range of commercial uses, and we also note that there's an existing building on the site which would provide a reasonable use of the property. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. And before I come back to the commission, I'd like to ask our staff counsel, Amy Roach, if she has any comments.
I would just like to make 3 points. One, we agree with Director Douglas's comments about takings. You don't get to a takings analysis here since we're talking about staff recommending denial based on there being alternatives. We're also talking about a buffer, which is a setback from wetland or environmentally sensitive habitat area, not an exaction. Second point is that under CEQA case law, an alternatives analysis and feasibility analysis are not driven by a tenant's economic interests. And then the third point is that this LCP does not distinguish between degraded wetlands and non-degraded wetlands. Under the LCP, all wetlands are protected regardless of whether they're degraded, and that has been upheld under case law as well, interpreting the Coastal Act protection of wetlands. That concludes my comments.
Thank you for your comments, and with that, I'll return to the commission, and I'll recognize Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Number A-1-EUR-06-028 for the development proposed by the applicant and recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Commissioner Neely. Is there a second? Commissioner Akajian seconded Commissioner Neely's motion.
And first,
would you like to speak to your motion?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to ask staff to while the commission is discussing this, come up with conditions that they would want to place on the project. And I just want to say that I want to really thank the staff for working with the applicants on this matter and trying to resolve it. There were a lot of design revisions submitted, and there's been a lot of cooperation with the applicants as well. I was pleased to see that California Department and Fish and Game did come on the site twice and do a good analysis there. And this is an infill redevelopment project. It's right on Broadway in downtown Eureka. It's a project to replace an old rundown truck stop that was put there in the 50s. And I think that these applicants in this project have gone a long way toward creating some real enhancements, some restorations, and some protections for Maurer Marsh, which I haven't seen other applicants do, so I want to thank them for that. There were a couple of things I wanted to point out. One was that on page 27 in the staff report, there's a chart that talks about that issue regarding flexibility in terms of the parking, that the parking spaces are 1.5 to 2.5 feet wider than what's required in the LCP, and that maybe that offers some options there for us. And I'll stop at that and let's hear from other commissioners and then come back later and hear from staff on some conditions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Neely. I'll go to Commissioner Akajian, who seconded. Do you have anything? Do you want to speak to the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at some of the aerial pictures, I think there is a lot of room that we can work and make the project happen rather than deny it. And some of the, even though we're talking about economical impact on the rental folks, but I think it's also applicable to the landlord as well. And seeing some of the trash brought forward because of it being a short thumb like sticks out there with all the pedestrian traffic and the trash, I think it will clean up and be a benefit to the environment as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Kaji. And Commissioner Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated the comments of Ms. Olson from the city, saying that she respected the commission and the staff processes. But I have to say that I'm disappointed that the city doesn't have greater respect for their own LCP and the standards in the LCP. I think when you have these buffer requirements and the city and their eagerness to be able to get a tenant in here approves a project with a 10-foot buffer, which is what it did in this case, it really sends a message, a very strange message to, you know, the applicants, to the people that are interested in terms of what they can and can't do there. And it puts the commission in a position where we're the bad guys and we got to come back and say, no, we'll enforce your rules if you won't enforce them yourself, which is unfortunate. And, it's not the first time that's happened with the city. The 100-foot buffer in terms of nexus, we have certainly over the years throughout the state of California demonstrated with good science that buffers are necessary for the function, the ongoing function of wetlands, and 100 feet is typically the minimum that we require, and often much larger buffers. So I don't have any problem at all with staff saying, you know, we can defend the 50-foot buffer, and frankly, I won't vote for anything that is less than an absolute 50-foot buffer for this particular project. I think Commissioner Neely indicates that, and staff has indicated that the reconfiguration of parking could provide more area in the front for the building in terms of reconfiguration. I would be open to that, but I think when you start a building like this and you look at the regs, you start with the buffer and then you design from there. You don't end up negotiating the buffer after you've designed the building.
Thank you, Commissioner Riley. Commissioner Wan.
Well, Commissioner Riley said a lot of what it is I was going to say. We started with a 100-foot buffer. The staff has agreed that you could reduce it to 50 feet. I haven't heard any science that indicates why less than 50 feet is adequate. And taking it and averaging still leaves a buffer in one area of less than 50 feet. And I don't see the science to support a less than 50-foot buffer. The development, as Commissioner Riley has indicated, is tenant-driven. Design the project for what the tenant wants and then try to fit the buffers into that. That's the wrong way to deal with this. And whatever happens here is permanent. It's at least for a long time. It's not going to be redeveloped. This is the time when you do it and you do it right. I can't support anything less than a 50-foot buffer, which is rather minimal, actually. And our staff biologist has indicated that the science says that less than 50 feet simply won't work. Those buffers are buffers that are permanent. They're not temporary. And it's just what does disturb me the most, however, is the fact that, and I remember what staff said, that we were told that we would continue this, you would come back to work towards a 50-foot buffer, and that hasn't happened. And I don't see, apparently there are alternatives that will work, just, and I think they may even work with this tenant, he just doesn't want to make changes. And I think that's just not a basis for this commission to say, okay, because the tenant doesn't like it, we're going to reduce the standards of the buffer, and we're going to reduce the width, and we're going to allow impacts to wetlands. And impacts to wetlands under the Coastal Act, that's pretty severe. And under your own LCP, it's not permitted.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Commissioner Blank, and then Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. I have a question for Director Douglas. It just seems that while the goal of the staff report and our actions are to protect the 9-acre Mara Marsh, I was incredibly disturbed to see those photographs and then hear the city say they're responsible for it. What action are we taking in regards to the city and the degradation of the marsh itself by lack of protection by the city?
Well, as the representative of the city said, we do have a good working relationship with the city. We disagree on some issues, but that's the nature of the division of institutional responsibility and the politics and the needs at the local level, economic development needs primarily. On issues such as restoration, maintaining or cleaning up areas that have been degraded in the past, we cooperate with the city as best we can. If there were anything that we could do to help them, we would do that, but we're not in a position to tell the city how to spend their resources to free this area of encampments that are degrading of the resource. We certainly encourage that and would urge that that be done, and if there's anything we can do to help, we would do that, but we're not in a position to force the city to take that kind of action.
I see. I could just see from the applicant's point of view of the buffer they're being asked to provide is described as a marsh, but to them it appears as a homeless encampment. It could certainly set up cognitive dissonance in the view of an applicant on the position the commission's taking. And I understand your response. I just wanted to observe that.
Right. Well, what I think Mr. Merrill pointed out is that the LCP makes no distinction between a fully functioning wetland and a degraded wetland. Obviously, there's degradation that's occurred here, but nevertheless, it's still a wetland that warrants protection under both the LCP and the Coastal Act.
Thank you. Commissioner Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sake of brevity, first of all, I'd like to say Vice Chair Neely's support for a project to me as another local elected official on the commission, I certainly embrace. But as Commissioner Riley and Commissioner Wong have articulately pointed out, as far as I'm concerned, without a uniform 50-foot buffer for Esha, it's dead on arrival. So I would be supportive of the project with that condition change. That's where I stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. I'd like to, since most of the commissioners have spoken, I'd like to speak to this as a commissioner and also a developer that knows something about this. Commissioner Riley did state, and Commissioner Wan said the right thing. You know, it's really development 101. The first thing you start with is a constraints analysis. Whether I'm the planner or I'm the owner, I'm the developer, I have any interest in this property, you have an LCP that has a 100-foot buffer. And that is in the law right now. And the Coastal Act doesn't provide for tenants or developers or anything, if some particular plan doesn't work, that we can just move buildings around, take away buffers, and change the LCP. And in this case, I don't see how you could ever argue there's some nexus for a taking or anything else. I can find 20 different ways to develop that site using a 50-foot buffer. And actually, I'm very surprised, and I have been surprised, and really I think you've convinced the commission this is a project that's good for Eureka, is that they'd even agree early on, like they talked about, that support 50 feet. To me, that's the home run for you. And honestly, I don't mistake my respect. I'd like to see a project here, but I would have run with that, developed a plan like that, come up with it, and embraced it and had everybody happy. Instead, we're put in a position today that if we, as commissioners, who would like to see a project up there, most of us, if not all of us, you've put us in a position where not only you're not going to meet the 100-foot buffer, you don't even want to meet the 50-foot buffer. And that's something that, and I have a lot of respect for Vice Chair Neely and the City of Eureka and everything else, but that's something we cannot do. And we certainly can't do it for the reasons that you're asking, because there's a lot of different ways and alternatives that you can make a very nice project up there. And it just doesn't have to be driven by, there's nowhere in the Coastal Act that it has to be a tractor sales will exempt the buffer area. We just can't do that. So I cannot support Vice Chair Neely's motion at this point. And I'll go to Vice Chair Neely, who I have a great deal of respect. Oh, who?
Condition from this.
Commissioner Baird, I'm sorry. I didn't see your hand down there.
That's okay. Just one question. I certainly wouldn't argue against a 50-foot buffer, and I don't know the history of this project. The one thing I do have to ask as a representing the Secretary for Resources is I look through this report to see some reference of the Fish and Game position or even like a copy of their analysis So that it would seem to me, I don't know what the nature of the dispute is or whatever between, or if there is, between the staff and the Department of Fish and Game, but I would hope that there would be, and it's our state wildlife manager, that there would be some discussion at least of whatever they have said. And I would think in the future, I'd certainly like to see that kind of analysis put in an appendix. I'm just unaware of it.
Well, there's no dispute with the Department of Fish and Game because they did not apply Coastal Act policies and standards relative to the protection of ESHA. They just said in discussions with our staff that based on their review of the project, they're okay with it. But that's not an analysis under the Coastal Act. So we understood that, and so, but our biologist applying the standards that the commission has consistently applied in the past came to a conclusion that this does not comply with the 50-foot that's necessary.
All right. I would just ask that that issue be addressed, that when I see...
In other words, describing what the difference is of opinion between...
Yeah, two. Because, you know, I you know, coming
well,
here with a stack...
Bob says it is in there.
Oh, it is in there. Okay. Yeah. Can you just direct me to where it is? That's all.
Sure, Commissioner Baird. If you look on the staff report, I think it begins at the bottom of page 20, and it goes through the first half of page 21. It refers to the fish and game letters and makes the point that the commission is looking for consistency with the LCP policies.
All right. In my warp speed look, okay. I hadn't seen it. I'm still not seeing it, actually, but I'll look.
It starts at the bottom of the table that's included on page 20. You see that?
It's okay. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to staff and talk about the conditions that staff would request for the project to be approved.
If we can, give you those conditions, but let me just ask a question of the commission. The way that the motion is framed and what the maker of the motion is suggesting is that it's approved per the applicant with then any suggested conditions that you might incorporate based on what we would suggest. If that motion fails, then this project is denied. And it may be, and then they would have to go back through the city and start again. Depending, and I'm not predicting how the vote would come out, but there is the potential for the commission to add conditions that maintain the 50-foot buffer and then the other conditions that we're talking about that would then allow this commission to approve the project and maintain the 50-foot, and they wouldn't have to go all the way back. So we can list all the conditions, and then maybe you could have, if you incorporate that, you could have a vote just on the 50-foot buffer issue, and then then you wouldn't lose the whole.
I see. Okay.
Right.
Well, it would be my intent actually to, based on the comments that have been made by commissioners, I don't think it's going to move forward without the 50-foot buffer.
So we'll read those into the record there,
Peter. Ms. Patterson.
Yeah.
I want to write.
Right
that.
Now, you have a motion. Per applicant to with a recommendation to approve.
Right.
My suggestion would be that you do an amending motion regarding the conditions proposed by staff and then any additional amending motions if there are any necessary in order to put on conditions that you so desire.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then with that in mind, I would move to amend the motion to add the 50-foot buffer.
Second.
Okay. It's been an amending motion to add the 50-foot buffer, and this was seconded by Commissioner Potter. Commissioner Clark?
Yeah. For the maker of the motion, Vice Chair, when you say add the 50-foot buffer, it has an average 50-foot buffer. You're talking specifically about a uniform 50-foot buffer.
Yes. Thank you for that clarification. It would be a uniform 50-foot buffer consistent with what the staff has proposed.
And through the chair, if I might just indicate the other kinds of conditions that we would recommend under this situation. We have given it some thought. There are quite a few because we'd basically be redesigning the project to some extent. But the basic The basic condition would be to submit a revised site plan that would be generally consistent with the plan submitted, except that it would provide for a minimum uniform 50-foot buffer around the full perimeter of the adjacent Marrer Marsh wetland and riparian eshas. We also think it'd be important to include criteria that they meet the city's parking standards, city standards for loading zones in the zoning code, standards for trash dumpsters and trash enclosures, that they also clarify in the plan that proposals that they've indicated would be part of the project but are not necessarily listed in the plan now is that there be a 6-foot tall cinder block wall erected along the property line at the inland edge of the buffer, that there be no window openings on the building on the west and west-facing elevations of the building, that there be no exterior lights installed along the western and southern sides of the building adjoining the buffer. Then, with regard to other conditions, for landscaping on the site other than the buffer, we'd recommend that there be a landscaping plan submitted for the review and approval by staff that would require that only native or non-invasive plant species be planted at the site, and that they not use rodenticides, and that the planting would be completed within 60 days after completion of construction, and that they maintain those plants over time. We'd require that they submit a utility plan that would provide for undergrounding of utilities in conformance with the city's LCP policies. Another condition would be to submit a signage plan demonstrating that all signage on the project would conform with LCP policies, including those relating to no neon or flashing signage, and also that they submit a plan that would provide for bicycle racks consistent with the LUP bicycle transportation policy. We would also recommend that there be a design restriction imposed that would restrict all exterior materials to non-reflective materials to minimize glare, and that they be limited to neutral or earth tone colors. And that the exterior lighting be the minimum amount necessary to provide for safe ingress and egress, and shall be low wattage, non-reflective, shielded, and have a directional cast downward so that it doesn't shine beyond the boundaries of the property. We'd also recommend that because there's a number of changes here and we're not sure how this comports with other city permit processes, that prior to issuance of the permit that the applicant submit evidence that the city has either granted all necessary approvals for this design or that they don't need to issue any further approvals. We'd also recommend that they include a erosion runoff control plan, which would include best management practices for erosion control during construction, and then also that for post-construction that runoff be addressed, and that it include an oil-water separator system for the water collected from the parking lots and the buildings to avoid degradation of water quality, and that they design the system that's installed to meet the commission's preferred approach of addressing the 85th percentile 24-hour storm event, that they obtain any necessary encroachment permit from the city or Caltrans, that they restrict the property so that future improvements that might otherwise be exempt under the commission's regulations would require an amendment to the permit. And then I'm getting close. The open space restriction over the buffer area would limit it to open space uses except for the removal of non-native vegetation and the installation of the various buffer improvements that are proposed. And then a buffer vegetative screening plan that would provide for the planting of the vegetation in the buffer, that would again provide for the minimum 50-foot wide buffer and an intermixing of planting of native plant restoration species. There'd be submitted for the review and approval of staff a monitoring program to ensure the successful establishment of the buffer vegetation and provisions for remediation if that doesn't work out. and that there be that the conditions of the permit be recorded as covenants and restrictions on the use of the property, and finally, that a condition that is more notification that this action has no effect on conditions imposed by the City of Eureka pursuant to authorities other than the Coastal Act. So, and those would be the conditions we'd recommend if the commission chooses to approve it with a minimum 50-foot buffer.
I want to ask the maker of the motion and the second of the amending motion, are they incorporating all the conditions that Mr. Merrill just stated on the record into their, are they accepting those conditions? Is that a yes, Commissioner Potter? It is. Okay. And with counsel, is there any other clarification, Ms. Roach or anybody else? Okay. Those are incorporated into the amending motion. And Commissioner Wan wants to say, add something.
I have a question here because it appears that these are adequate conditions, but the one thing that I am always hesitant to do is to design a project in the hearing room. Some usually doesn't work out right. Now, I understand that the problem here is that if we deny, they have to go back through the City of Eureka process. Is there a way, and I know we've done this in the past, that if we were deny, that they could come to us without going through the city and just come back? We could waive the fees and they could come back. I don't know how you want to do. Is there a way to do that? If there's no way to do it, then I'll support this. Okay.
No, you can't.
I'm just not that. You understand what I'm saying?
Right,
I'm not that comfortable with all of those, you know.
Well, Commissioner Wan, you can't do it here because the city has a certified LCP. If it were original jurisdiction, that'd be different. The other thing is, I'm sorry that you're in this situation. We tried to avoid it by working with the applicant, and we would have had all of these conditions, and I believe there have been some discussions of these issues, so it's not that like they're new to them. But this is the best way for you to be able to act on it, allow them to know that they've got a permit approval from you and maintain the 50-foot buffer.
Commissioner Rowley, before I call the question.
Yeah, and I'm assuming, because of the nature of the conditions that are being proposed by staff, that in the nature of this and history of this application, that staff had given some thought to these conditions prior to the meeting and just didn't make them up on the spot, right?
I think you've got that one right. The one set of conditions that Bob didn't mention is just the standard conditions that would also be incorporated.
Okay. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on the amending motion? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved.
We have revised findings.
We need a main motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it does include the minimum 50-foot buffer.
Yes. Okay. Yes, it does.
That's the amendment. On the main motion, there's not any other questions. Is there any objection to a unanimous roll call yes vote on that? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. And then we have one other item, I believe, a findings.
That's correct, Commissioner Kruger. This is item 9A, which are the revised findings for the Delaware County LCP amendment, known as Hoburg. The county had requested certification of the amendment to redesignate the land use and zoning designations of an approximately 10-acre area comprised of 7 1-to-3-acre parcels. The commission had, the staff had recommended initial denial and then certification with modifications. The commission determined that they wished to deny it. And so these revised findings reflect the commission's action. The commission, the comments made at the hearing on the item indicated that they thought that the existing transitional zoning in the LCP from low-density residential to higher density was appropriate and that should remain, and felt that that was particularly important given that not only was it an issue of buffering residential from forest production, but habitat issues on the adjoining lands, and we hope that the findings that we prepared reflect what you intended on that item. No. So we'd recommend that at the close of the hearing that the commission adopt the revised findings contained in the staff report, and the motion to adopt is found on page 3 of the staff report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. We have no speaker slips, no public hearing. The commissioners are eligible to vote that are here are Commissioner Potter, Commissioner Riley, Commissioner Juan, and myself. Would somebody make...
Mr. Chair, I move commission adopt the revised findings.
Moved by Commissioner Riley, seconded by Commissioner Juan. With all those people in favor of the findings, raise their hand.
That's the appropriate number to adopt the findings?
Yes. Because there's only five. The findings have been adopted by the
thank
commission.
You, and,
thank you.
You've got 20 minutes to check out of the hotel.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next month.
And don't forget, the next meeting is a 4-day meeting in Santa Barbara starting on Tuesday.
Thank you.